Hello, everyone, and a very happy Sunday evening. Yeah, as Ken mentioned, we have a special member meeting in about an hour, which I'm really excited about. But first, I am here for the guiding light, and I am sharing from the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And tonight, we are going to begin a new section. It starts on page 48 in the book called Silence and Solitude. Before I begin, I would like to play a song. The song is related to kind of a couple of things going on with me right now. One, last night we actually watched Cinderella here in the house. So we watched Cinderella last night. And then two, there are some challenges with this retreat house, and so the song is kind of related to that too, since that's something I'm really involved in right now. If you haven't guessed yet, the song is that song from Cinderella, Impossible, which starts off singing impossible and then ends up singing it's possible. So this is the song from Cinderella. This is the Brandy and Whitney Houston version.
Impossible for a plane to be cast, plain country bumpkin and a prince to join in marriage, and four white mice will never be four white horses, such fol-de-rol and fiddle-dee-dee of courses, impossible, but the world is full of zanies and fools, who don't believe in sensible rules, and won't believe what sensible people say. And because these daft and dewy-eyed dopes keep building up impossible hopes, impossible things are happening every day. Impossible, 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 impossible.
That song. So why don't we go ahead and get started then? The spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, beginning the section called Silence and Solitude, page 48. So the devotee asks, is a vow of silence useful? Good question, huh? What do you guys think Ramana Maharshi is going to say? Is a vow of silence useful? And here's the answer. The inner silence is self-surrender. And that is living without the sense of ego. So what I hear Ramana Maharshi saying is a vow of outer silence, like a vow of not speaking, really isn't in itself that useful, because your mind could be, completely active, even though you've learned not to talk. You can just imagine, you know, maybe a bunch of monks living together, not speaking, but in their minds judging the hell out of each other, you know, judging how this one cooks and how this one cleans and how this one is, you know, makes funny noises when he breathes, and and yet there's no talking going on, right? So, so the outer vow of silence, you know, it doesn't have much meaning for Ramana Maharshi. What does have meaning is literally letting go of the ego. He called that self-surrender, surrendering the self, letting go of the self, living without a sense of ego or a sense of I, individual, separate self. That's what he says is useful. And that, of course, at least to me, makes perfect sense. So again, is a vow of silence useful? Ramana Maharshi, the inner silence is self-surrender, and that is living without the sense of ego. Now, before I go to this next question, I'm going to look up a word. Where is it? Oh, here it is. Oh, sannyasin is the word, and it's an ascetic or a renunciate, sannyasin. So the question, is solitude necessary for a sannyasin? So is it necessary for an ascetic? Ramana Maharshi answers, solitude is in the mind of a man. One might be in the thick of the world and yet maintain perfect serenity of mind. Such a person is always in solitude. Another may stay in the forest, but still be unable to control his mind. He cannot be said to be in solitude. Solitude is an attitude of the mind. A man attached to the things of life cannot get solitude wherever he may be. A detached man is always in solitude. So that's a pretty simple answer, right? Solitude has nothing to do with where the physical body is or with the physical environment or what appears to be going on. It has everything to do with, he called it an attitude of the mind. It has everything to do with where our focus is. So a person could appear to be very, very busy. You know, maybe a CEO of two or three companies even, and on the board of a couple more. And yet if he's able to maintain that detached attitude and just remain the watcher, just moving intuitively and really being silent within, then in spite of what appears to be a lot of outer activity, Ramana Maharshi calls that one in solitude. Where again, the monks that I made up a moment ago in that monastery, where they're not even speaking, but they're judging each other in their minds, that would not be a state of solitude. So Ramana Maharshi isn't at all concerned about the traditions of solitude. Again, Ramana Maharshi is concerned about us letting go of the ego. In this particular paragraph, that's referred to as being detached, right? Not being overly concerned about anything that happening, allowing the temporary to be temporary, allowing that which comes to come, that which goes to go, doing whatever work comes to me to do, but then when it's done, letting it go. I'll just read the paragraph again, but I think it's a clear, simple answer that we all understand. Again, is solitude necessary for an ascetic or a renunciate? The answer, solitude is in the mind of a man. One might be in the thick of the world and yet maintain perfect serenity of mind. Such a person is always in solitude. Another may stay in the forest but still be unable to control his mind. He cannot be said to be in solitude. Solitude is an attitude of the mind. A man attached to things of life cannot get solitude wherever he may be. A man detached is always in solitude. So the first question we've looked at was about silence, right? Is a vow of silence useful? And the second question was about solitude. And it really appears Ramana Maharshi sees silence and solitude as the same, because in effect he gave the same answer, right? It's all about the self-surrender and the detachment, the letting go of ego. That's both silence and solitude. And it doesn't matter whether they're speaking or not. It doesn't matter where the body is. It doesn't matter what the body's doing. It's all about the mind. Now, again, I need to look up a word. Okay, the word is mana, and it means silence. It means silence. So the question is, what is mana, or what is silence? And here's the answer. The state which transcends speech and thought is silence. It is meditation without mental activity. Subjugation of the mind is meditation. Deep meditation is eternal speech. Silence is ever speaking. It is the perennial flow of language. It is interrupted by speaking, for words obstruct this mute language. Lectures may entertain individuals for hours without improving them. Silence, on the other hand, is permanent and benefits the whole of humanity. By silence, eloquence is meant. Oral lectures are not so eloquent as silence. Silence is unceasing eloquence. It is the best language. There is a state when words cease and silence prevails. So, silence is the communication that heals. And of course, silence has no preference or attitudes or judgments or decisions or declarations in it. Right? It's silence. Hey, here's a problem. Heal this thing. Silence is just silent. It's just ising. It's just being. And yet, through its nature, it heals. Isn't that amazing? No intention to heal, no desire to heal, and yet by its nature it heals. And that healing energy that brings all things into harmony, and you could say makes all things right, Ramana Maharshi is referring to as language. He calls it a mute language and says that words obstruct this mute language. So let's go through this answer a little slowly, a little more slowly. And I think I might just look up a few words as we go along. Really look at the definitions of words, even though we think we know what words mean. Sometimes we can get some additional look at those words. So the question, what is mana or silence? And the answer is, that state which transcends speech and thought is mana or silence. So again, it has nothing to do with keeping your mouth shut and your mind busy, right? Silence transcends both speech and thought. So we're talking complete silence. He says it is meditation without mental activity. So again, You can see exactly what he means by silence. Meditation without mental activity, the state that transcends both speech and thought. And then he says, subjugation of the mind is meditation. So I'm just going to go ahead and peek at that word subjugation in the dictionary. Okay, so subjugate is the best I can do. To bring under domination or control. Well, that's exactly what I would have thought it meant, was control. So that appears to be what it means. I didn't see another definition there.
Okay, who would
So,
like to do?
subjugation of the mind is meditation. Deep meditation is eternal speech. Now, when he says control of the mind, control in this case is the opposite of letting the mind do whatever it wants, letting the mind wander everywhere, think this, think that. My experience has been that it isn't really the mind we control, it's our attention that we control. And as we control the attention and we move the attention away from the mind and place it with awareness or even with breathing or even with the sounds of the environment, just with anything other than thought, that thought naturally grows quieter. So we don't really, at least in my experience, we don't, even though the word here is to control the mind, subjugate the mind, we don't really control the mind. We control the attention. We move the attention away from the mind, and then the mind naturally grows quiet because the mind seems to need attention in order to thrive. And again, the mind can grow very quiet just by closing the eyes and listening to whatever is in the environment. You know, if you find your attention going back to thought, you just turn your attention back to what's in the environment. And the environment doesn't have to be a spiritual sound. I mean, like I do have birds outside that I can listen to. It sounds like someone upstairs is doing laundry too, so I can listen to the noise that the washing machine is making. You know, Jamie's laying here next to me, kind of going, you know, kind of breathing through her nose, chopping her lips. I can listen to her. I'll just be quiet for a moment and let us all listen to whatever our environments are. And just notice how when you're listening to your environment, that the mind, if you really keep your intention with the sounds, but the mind gets quiet while you're listening. Just listen for the joy of hearing. Listen like listening is your greatest joy, like you just live to listen. You love to hear sounds. Notice that if you're really giving your attention to listening, the mind actually goes quiet. Because the mind needs your attention in order for it to be really active. So it's not really the mind that we're controlling. We didn't have to control the mind in that case. We controlled where our attention was. Right? Like I was, although there are a few sounds in my environment to choose from, I chose to really listen to the sound of the washing machine, which is directly above me. And I can hear the motor, I can hear the water spinning. It must be in spin cycle right now. I could actually hear the water. Now it's making a louder noise. But you know, as I was really listening, like I just wanted to really, really hear that washing machine, there was no thought. So Ramana Maharshi is saying that is meditation, right? Sitting there, letting your mind chat and chat and chat and paying attention to it is not meditation. Controlling the attention so that the mind goes silent, that is meditation. And then he says, Deep meditation is eternal speech. So staying with a focus, and usually, you know, I start with sounds or I start with sensations in the body. Those are the two places I tend to start when I'm meditating. And I pay a lot of attention to the sound, or I pay a lot of attention to the feeling, the sensation in the body, until the mind is good and quiet. And then I start practicing self-inquiry. And this is to shift me into awareness, watching awareness. So like if I'm listening to the washing machine and I'm really paying attention to it, and the mind is now quiet and the attention is fully on the machine, then I ask, what sees? Even though I'm hearing, I always say what sees for some reason. What sees this sound? What sees this sound? And I start turning the attention towards the awareness that is aware of the sound of the washing machine. I pay attention to that. And then, you know, I ask, okay, so what sees that? What sees this attention that sees the washing machine? And I just keep using self-inquiry to move myself back further and further and further. Well, we could call it going deeper and deeper and deeper. And this deep meditation, where we go way deep within awareness, that is what Ramana Maharshi is calling eternal speech. And that's a very, very interesting, eternal speech. Now, I think I know what speech means, but I'm going to go ahead and look that up too for the fun of it. See if there's something here. Speech. There's two definitions. The first one is the expression or the ability to express thoughts and feelings by articulating sounds. Well, that is clearly not the speech we're looking for. But the second one is a formal address or discourse delivered to an audience. So I think that one is probably the definition that applies, in that when we are in that deep, deep silence, the universe is listening. You know, the universe is the audience. And the universe is listening to what I'm going to call the song of truth. And we're in that deep, deep silence. He calls it eternal speech. So although in that moment we are not focused on thought, we are not focused on any desire. There's nothing we want to correct. There's nothing we want to change. We are just focused on awareness. At that point, in that deep meditation, where we actually begin to communicate at the universal level with the universe without any will. We have no will. We don't go there and try to communicate about something, because that would be a thought. We're just abiding as the self, and the natural communication is occurring. Communication that's beyond the mind or any of the mind's wishes or desires or judgments. So again, he says, deep meditation is eternal speech. Silence is ever speaking. It is the perennial flow of language. So there's a couple words I want to look up here. The first one is perennial. So perennial is lasting or existing for a long or apparently infinite time, enduring or continually recurring, right? So silence is ever speaking. It is the perennial flow of language. I'm just going to look up language. The first one says the method of human communication. The second one says the system of communication used by a particular community. I'm going to go with that second one. In this case, the particular community is consciousness. Consciousness as the universe. So silence is the ongoing language or system of communication that is used within consciousness. So again, silence is ever speaking. It is the perennial flow of language. And then he says, it is interrupted by speaking. So now, of course, he's referring to human speak, which includes thought. Right? It's interrupted by thought. It is interrupted by speaking, for words obstruct this mute language. And of course, the reason for that is, you know, it's to some degree the attention is now turned to the head, to ideas, to concepts. So it's a stepping out of it's a stepping out of the communication of the universe, which has no will, has no concepts, has no ideas, has no desires. Right? It's stepping out of that when we return to words. Lectures may entertain individuals for hours without improving them. And I think we all know this to be true, right? We can go to retreats, for example, and we can listen for hours and hours and hours and really have a wonderful retreat and go home. And if we aren't going into the silence on our own, no change occurs. You know, we go home and pretty soon we feel like we lost whatever we might have felt like we had at the retreat. We lost it. And that's because lectures include words, which are actually an obstruction to the language of the universe, the language that heals. Lectures may entertain individuals for hours without improving them. Silence, on the other hand, is permanent and benefits the whole of humanity. You know, if we just sit in silence for an hour every day, we gain more than we would listening to a teacher speak to us all day long. And not only do we gain more, but the universe also gains. Gain maybe isn't the right word. I'm going to say the universe is also gifted. It's gifted by the silence. We are gifted, and the universe is gifted by the silence. Imagine that, you know, just to choose to spend an hour a day with the eyes closed, moving attention away from thought and placing it with awareness. We are entering into a flow of communication that benefits us and all the universe. Wow. Silence, on the other hand, is permanent and benefits the whole of humanity. By silence, eloquence is meant. So let's look up eloquence. Fluent, persuasive speaking or writing. So fluent or persuasive. So fluent would be expressing oneself easily and articulately. And then through being silent, we are fluent. We express ourselves easily and articulately in the language that is no language. Whoops, I think I just lost my recording because I think Windows just decided to reboot. I don't know, Ken, if you're backing this up, but I can tell by that noise that my Windows just rebooted, which means I lost my recording. Yay! Okay, thank you. I'll need that. So just by being silent, we are being fluent in the language of the universe. Think about that. You don't have to learn the language of the universe. Right? You are fluent. You are articulate in the language of the universe just by being completely silent, by turning your attention away from thought and placing it with awareness. And then it also says persuasive. I'm going to edit persuasive slightly, in that there's really nothing to persuade. I would say what's really happening with the language of the universe is that we are harmonizing. Right? We're naturally harmonizing with the universe. And therefore, it brings things into harmony. You know, we don't have to persuade it. We just naturally harmonize with it. So that's the eloquence. By silence, eloquence is meant. Oral lectures are not so eloquent as silence. Silence is unceasing eloquence. Hi, Hal. It is the best language. There is a state when words cease and silence prevails. And of course, here he's talking about awakening to the first principle of God, right? There is a state where words cease and silence prevails, unending, even if words are still speaking, right? When Ramana Maharshi or Nisargadatta are speaking, they are still in silence. So at that level, the words do no longer obstruct. They are just an outpouring of the silence. Question. How then can we communicate our thoughts to one another? Now, hi, Jasmine. That's a little bit funny to me because it tells me that the questioner doesn't really hear, because he's talking about a state that's completely beyond thought, a state where there is no self-will, a state where I'm not trying to achieve anything, right? I am literally just absorbed in beingness. And so there would be no thoughts that I want to communicate to anyone, right? There would be none. And this is what I think Ramana Maharshi has very clearly stated. But apparently the questioner did not understand that, because his question is, well, how then can we communicate our thoughts to one another, right? If we're all just sitting around in silence, you know, how can I tell people what I think? And Ramana Maharshi just kind of acquiesces. He says, that becomes necessary if the sense of duality exists. Now, this is different than saying that becomes necessary in duality. Right? He's not saying in duality, we have to communicate our thoughts to one another. That is not what he's saying. He is not saying that becomes necessary in duality. He says, that becomes necessary if the sense of duality exists. So if you still see yourself as a person, which really means that you're still believing yourself to be the mind, and you still see that another person here, and you have a thought in your head that you want to communicate to that other person, well, then you're going to have to use words. If that's your perception, you're going to have to use words. But again, when Ramana Maharshi speaks, when Nisargadatta speaks, the speaking is an outpouring of the silence, right? Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta have both kind of described themselves as in a state of sleepwalking and of having no will of their own, right? Not trying to influence anything. Nisargadatta says that his speaking for him is the same as your hair growing, right? You don't ever think about your hair growing. It just grows. It just happens. It comes from the silence, right? Your thoughts do not make your hair grow. It comes from the silence. And his speaking is the same. So it may seem to be a subtle difference, you know, where this person is asking, you know, how do I get my thoughts to another person if I don't speak? But see, this person has a will in that. My thoughts. I think, you know, we should do X instead of Y. And I want to explain to you why we should do X, because I want to persuade you to do X instead of Y, right? So there's a lot of self-will in that. And with Ramana Maharshi being at ease with everything as it is, any speaking that happens just happens, but there is no self-will, there is no intention, and therefore there is still silence. It kind of goes back to where he began this discussion when asked, is a vow of silence useful? And he answered, the inner silence is self-surrender, and that is living without a sense of ego. Right? So silence is no ego, no self-will, no thoughts that I want to communicate to you. So again, the questioner asks, how then can we communicate our thoughts to one another? And Ramana Maharshi says, that becomes necessary if the sense of duality exists. Okay, here comes another question. It makes me giggle. Why does not Bhagavan go about and preach the truth to the people at large? You know, why doesn't Ramana Maharshi do what the Jehovah's Witnesses do, knock on everybody's door and tell them the truth? Why does not Bhagavan go about and preach the truth to the people at large? And then, now this answer is quite long, actually. It's the longest answer I've come across, three paragraphs. But I think we have time maybe to do all three. He says, how do you know I am not doing it? Does preaching consist in mounting a platform and harangue, I don't know this word, I'm going to say bullying the people around? haranguing the people around. Preaching is simple communication of knowledge. It can really be done in silence only. What do you think of a man who listens to a sermon for an hour and goes away without having been impressed by it so as to change his life? Compare him with another who sits in a holy presence and goes away after some time with his outlook on life totally changed. Which is the better, to preach loudly without effect, or to sit silently sending out the inner force? Yeah, that's the word, Jay. He wrote the word in there. Well, it only has one R. Jay has three R's. It only has one R. But that's basically the word. Again, Ramana Maharshi says, how does speech arise? There is abstract knowledge whence arises the ego, which in turn gives rise to thought, and thought to the spoken word. So the word is the great grandson of the original source. Listen to this again very carefully. First, there is abstract knowledge. Knowing occurs. And then the ego arises, and then puts a thought to that knowledge, and then that thought, out of that thought comes a spoken word. So the word is the great grandson of the original source. You know, we do have knowledge without thought. I think that's just incredible. You know, if you see something that you've never ever seen before, you know, the only thought you may have, you know, if it's something, let's say, that's extremely beautiful, I mean, the only thought you may have is, wow. You know, just, wow. But yet, at the same time, you now have knowledge of this thing. You know, depending on what it is, you know what it looks like. You might know what it smells like. If it's something you taste, you might know what it tastes like. If it makes a noise, you might know what it sounds like. You immediately, without a single thought, have knowledge. And then the thoughts may come up and think about everything. You know, like the other day, I've seen a few fires. I've seen a couple start. I saw one start the other day. And I watched the fire grow over a 30-hour period approximately. And in the 30th hour, what I saw from that fire was something I've never seen before, and I've definitely seen fires before. I watched this fire cross, first it crest the top of a mountain range, and then devour four mountains, the side of four mountains, in approximately 30 minutes. It was just so fast moving. And it really was watching it. I mean, the only thought was, wow. Because I've never seen anything like that before. But then after that, you know, we had a fire a couple days later. We had a fire start here in Pueblo. And the fire started on Friday in Pueblo. And in fact, I saw that fire when it started too. Jacqueline's with me. So that's three fires I've seen right after they started. So that fire starting too. And I told Ron about it, and we were supposed to be going an hour and a half north the next day to a Renaissance fair. And I told Ron that this fire wasn't that far from my house. I told Ron, you know, we might have to wait and see how the fire is doing in the morning before we decide if we want to go that far away from the house or not. Because if they evacuate us, you know, we want to be home to grab what we want. And we're evacuated because they don't let you come back in to get it, right? And Ron said, oh, that fire won't, you know, Ron said, oh, a fire won't spread that far that fast. And I said, you wouldn't say that if you saw what I saw yesterday. You see, that's the ego arising, right? I'm now communicating my thoughts. Here's what I saw. I, the ego, saw a fire devour four mountains in 30 minutes. I now know that a fire can move really fast, so I think this is how we should be concerning this fire. You see? So the knowledge was turned into mental knowledge, and then you could say the past applied to the present as if something was known. But the knowledge that occurred in the moment of watching that first fire didn't have thought in it other than, wow, right? So all of that later conversation that I had with Ron on the next day about how fast a fire should move and whether we should go to the Renaissance fair or not, that was the great-grandson of the knowledge that occurred with awareness, just awareness watching a fire burn. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about this. He talks about what he, you know, the initial knowledge and then the secondary thinking that happens. You know, like if you touch a stove or you know, you touch a stove, boom, you initially, immediately know that you want to remove your hand from that hot stove, right? You don't, you don't have to think about it. You know, you touch a hot stove, you get burned, and you know you want to pull your hand away. That's knowledge. But then you might talk about it. You might say, oh my gosh, I was so stupid. You know, I didn't grab a pot holder, or, you know, I just leaned over and touched the stove, or, you know, that was so dumb of me. I can't believe I was that dumb, you know. Those are all secondary thoughts. They're the ego adding to the knowledge that when you touch a hot stove, it burns. So, again, Ramana Maharshi says, again, how does speech arise? There is abstract knowledge, whence arises the ego, which in turn gives rise to thought, and thought to the spoken word. So the word is the great grandson of the original source. If the word can produce effect, judge for yourself how much more powerful must be the preaching through silence. Right? How much more powerful is the abstract knowledge itself? And if we take that back to the fire example, you know, I can tell people about how fast that fire moved. And there were probably, you know, 50 to 80 people that I saw along the road watching it with me. So those 50 to 80 people have the same knowledge I have, right? They saw it too. Everybody else, when we tell you about it or when you read about it in the paper, because you can also read about it, what you do not have the exact knowledge. You have your imagination's version of it based on the words that we communicate to you. Which do you think is the better knowledge, your imagination of what I saw, or if you had been standing there seeing it with me? Right? So the source is the better source of knowledge. And this is why in gentle healing, why we lead everyone to find their own inner teacher and then to go to the inner teacher yourself. Notice I'm not teaching you guys to email me with all of your questions. It's not that I couldn't provide an answer. It's just that when I provide the answer, it's going to come through thought. It's going to come through words. And then you, with your literal imagination, although you may think you're just understanding my communication, you're going to be imagining what I mean by those words. Therefore, your learning cannot be near as good or near as perfect as it would be if you learn from directly within yourself. Because when you learn from directly within yourself, even if words are given, even if you hear words and you write those words down on paper, the silence is there. And you're actually hearing the direct communication of the silence. You know, when I read Ramana Maharshi or I read Nisargadatta Maharaj or, you know, some other teachers, I pause sometimes to look up words because I want to try and get the best idea of the meaning they're communicating. But if you go back and listen to every NTI teaching I've ever done, you're never once going to hear me look up a word. Do you know why? Because I received every one of those words from within me. They had the quality of silence to them, and I know exactly what they mean. That's why. I don't have to look up those words. But sometimes I do, and you know, have to look up, if I'm reading Nisargadatta or Ramana Maharshi, you know, it's like, well, let's look up this word and see if we can figure out exactly what he's trying to say here. And some words have several meanings, and you'll find a particular meaning, and that will resonate, and you'll say that one. But that's because we're getting it secondhand, or, you know, we're getting it secondhand. So the best communication is the communication that comes from the silence. And when you have a question, to go to your inner teacher and ask it the question and let it give you the answer, then even if the answer comes with words, it is coming directly from the silence, and you know exactly what it means. You may tell others about it, and then they may interpret the words differently and imagine the message differently, but you know exactly what that means. So again, Ramana Maharshi says, if the word can produce effect, judge for yourself, how much more powerful must be the preaching through silence? But people do not understand this simple, bare truth, the truth of their everyday, ever-present, eternal experience. This truth is that of the self. Is there anyone unaware of the self? But they do not like even to hear of this truth, whereas they are eager to know what lies beyond, about heaven, hell, and reincarnation. Now, for those of you who pay attention to my words, my teaching, you know that I have attempted to create my realization of truth that I've realized from within. I've attempted to communicate it using a model called the Four Principles of God. So what Ramana Maharshi is saying here is people are more interested in the fourth principle of God, which includes things like heaven and hell and reincarnation, than they are the first principle of God, truth. They would much rather hear about, you know, all of their different lives, you know, who they were before. They like to hear stories about how what they did in that life, you know, hundreds of years ago has led to the pain that they feel with their partner in this life. You know, people love stuff like that. Sometimes I feel like the fantasy buster when I'm in front of certain audiences. Sometimes when I'm teaching, I'm invited to audiences who have lots of wonderful stories about how souls came into this world and what happens to a soul after they leave this world, and they love these stories. And of course, when I teach, I have to be true to the teaching. And so if they ask a direct question, I have to tell them, just that's not true. None of that is true. And so I see the look on their face, and I feel like I've just taken candy from a baby. But Ramana Maharshi is saying, people are much more eager for that than the truth. People do not understand the simple, bare truth, the truth of their everyday, ever-present, eternal experience. This truth is that of the self. Is there anyone unaware of the self? But they do not like even to hear of this truth, whereas they are eager to know what lies beyond, about heaven, hell, and reincarnation. Because they love mystery and not the truth, religions cater to them so as eventually to bring them round to the self. Whatever the means adopted, you must at last return to the self. So why not abide in the self here and now? To be a spectator of, or to speculate about the other world, the self is necessary. Therefore, they are not different from the self. So when he says to be a spectator of, or to speculate about the other world, the self is necessary. I always tell people, in order to have any experience at all, whether it's a good experience or whether it's a bad experience, you need awareness has to be present first. Right? I can't have a glorious day with my family if I am not first awareness. I cannot have the worst day imaginable where I feel like a total victim of everything happening to me without awareness first. Right? Awareness is the foundation that is required for any experience. And so that's what Ramana Maharshi is saying here. He says to be a spectator of or to speculate about the other world. Because again, people are interested in reincarnation, heaven, hell, dimensions, all of these kinds of things. Even to think about that stuff, the self is present. I mean, the self is so clear, like a window is clear, that it's not even noticed as people are speculating about, future lives, past lives, different dimensions. Is there another dimension in time, just like this dimension of time, except in the other one I didn't make this decision, I made another one, right? All that kind of stuff. The self is there the whole time. The whole time. So to be a spectator of or to speculate about the other world, the self is necessary. Therefore, they are not different from the self, right? The self is the foundation of every thought, of every speculation. Even the ignorant man, when he sees the objects, sees only the self. So that's the end of the answer. So again, the question was, why does not Bhagavan go about and preach the truth to the people at large? And it appears that Ramana Maharshi's first answer was, how do you know I'm not doing it? If we look at NTI, NTI, Luke chapter 9, says, everyone who reads my word, listens to my word, and practices my word, teaches my word. There can be no exception. You who are reading this now are my holy teacher. Do not let this make you afraid. Do not worry about what is expected of you based on this assignment. Nothing is expected of you except one thing, that you listen to me. Do not worry where you are to go, what you are to do, and what you are to say or to whom. Do not worry how you are to teach. Now listen to this next sentence. I may have you teach without a single spoken word. That is exactly what Ramana Maharshi is saying. This says, I may have you teach without a single spoken word. And Ramana Maharshi's answer to the question, why don't you go out there and teach people? He says, how do you know I'm not? Right? He's teaching without a single spoken word. He's abiding in the silence, harmonizing with the universe, and all grace comes from that. All realizations that we receive within ourselves comes from that harmonizing. The second answer he gives to that is an explanation that physical words are not as clear as the original source. That even if, when he does speak to people, again, you know, all words are concepts, and you know, even if I use with you the clearest concepts I can to describe what I am attempting to describe, your understanding of those concepts can be different, and therefore you understand something different than I intended. Right? So when we communicate with words, there's always the opportunity for miscommunication. In fact, miscommunication is extremely rampant. Right? Very common. So the best way to learn is to go into the silence, or at least to ask the inner teacher, because then even those words come from the silence. And that way, there's no interpretation happening. You're getting knowledge from the source. So that's his second answer. And then his third answer to the question is, bluntly, most people aren't interested in the truth anyway. You know, why would I go about teaching the truth when that's really not what people care about? They care about spiritual ideas and concepts, but they don't care about truth. And that is the end of this section, Silence and Solitude. So we finished that section in one night. So what I am going to do is pause for a moment because I have to shift gears. I was going to ask Ken to play a song while I stop and start the recording, but I don't need to do that because I don't have a recording. Mine got eaten halfway through, so Ken has the recording. So what I will do is release the mic to Ken. I'll let him do his usual thing, make an announcement. That will be my pause. And then when he gives the mic back to me, I will move into the member meeting. All right? Releasing the mic.